This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Pamela Whitten is going to be, in just a matter of weeks, actually, the 19th president of Indiana University, and she is making rounds of the regional campuses, including IU Northwest here in Gary. And she is with us on the phone from the Gary campus. And President-elect Whitten, thank you for joining us on Lakeshore Public Radio.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, tell us, if you will, first, what you've had a chance to see since you visited the Gary campus and what you're doing on campus and some of the other regional campuses as you're making your tours.
Well, I'm taking the next few days to take the opportunity to visit really a very important asset for IU, and that's our five regional campuses. And so I'm at my second campus today in Gary, and they were kind enough to make a big, beautiful, sunny day for me here while I'm here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, primarily we've, of course, seen some of the campus, which is beautiful, and I am my expectations have been exceeded, I will say, in terms of walking across the campus. It's gorgeous, the facilities, the programs that are in play. But if I'm very, very honest, the highlight of the day so far is all the time that I'm getting to spend with students. And so I had a nice session where I got to meet with some student leaders from campus, and they were fantastic and smart and articulate and thoughtful, and they love their university. And then I also had a nice chance to speak with a group of student athletes who, of course, are quite committed not only to their sport but to their academics as well. And so that truly has been the highlight. I'm sitting close by the chancellor, and I hope I'm not insulting him by stating that really, really the joy of the day is this time with students.
What are some of the things that interested you the most when the opportunity came about to be able to apply for the job of president at Indiana University?
Well, if you'll let me put it simply, it's Indiana University, mm-hmm. quite frankly. You know, it's from afar, I've always viewed this as one of the best public institutions, really, of higher education, really, across the U.S. And so, you know, to have the opportunity to come serve as the leader of this institution, which it plays such a pivotal role, of course, in Indiana, but really beyond in the nation and the world, is really the opportunity of a lifetime.
Do you think this is a great opportunity not only to have a chance to meet with students, but also to meet with faculty members, as you no doubt have had, at least certainly at IU Northwest here today, but through all the campuses, including the main campus at Bloomington?
Absolutely, absolutely. And so I was in South Bend last night and this morning and had the chance to do that. And then later on the agenda today, you're just catching before I'm getting the chance to meet with very many, but that certainly is an important part. Mm-hmm. You know, they play, you know, the students are the heart of the university, and then the faculty are certainly the soul of the university. And so I'm looking forward to those conversations about what's wonderful and what we can do to help them be more successful.
And coming from Kennesaw State University, do you see any parallels, even though you're talking about one university in particular, and now you're talking about almost a statewide system of campuses coming together, including the Bloomington campus? Are there a lot of things that are similar or things that are different that you're taking in from your other places that you have been to IU?
That's a good question, and I will say I really think it's the portfolio of my experience that, you know, brings the good analogy to IU. And so, you know, I've spent time on the faculty at the University of Kansas Medical Center years ago, which was nice exposure to academic medicine, which, of course, is a highlight at IU. I spent really my entire academic career at Michigan State, you know, at an AAU school in the Big Ten, as a regular old college professor, working my way through the ranks, very active in research, and eventually was a dean at Michigan State. And then I moved down to Athens, Georgia, where I was the provost at the University of Georgia for a number of years before moving to Kennesaw State, where I currently serve as the president, which is it's a large, 41,000 plus Metro Atlanta school, fairly diverse population as well. And so, you know, it's really the culmination from those four institutions that I think has well prepared me for the breadth and the range that is IU.
You've had this opportunity, of course, in your past positions to work with people on your particular campuses and dealing with not only research, but philanthropic support as well, too. Are these sorts of things you're going to take into the job as being the next Indiana University president?
Absolutely, absolutely. An important part of serving in leadership at any public higher ed institution now is looking to generate all forms of revenue, and sometimes creative and innovative sources of revenue. And that includes, seeking support from friends and alum and corporations and nonprofits and others to help support students in the activities of the university. And I will say it is a very easy thing to do when you really believe in the things that you're raising funds for.
Now, as you're going into the new position with Indiana University, it's a very difficult time in many respects. Not only we're still dealing with health issues and safety issues because of the pandemic, coming out of that from your previous position with Kennesaw State University, of course, and you're coming into a time here, too, where we have very serious concerns about inequities as far as students and faculty are concerned, as far as racial inequities are concerned. There's going to be some challenges ahead. Are you up to the challenge, do you feel?
I do, these are not challenges that are unique, frankly, to the state of Indiana. These are really national challenges, from both perspectives. From your first example, we've all, as higher education leaders, been working diligently to attempt to, successfully keep students making progress toward degrees while keeping them safe and healthy. And now we're all in the much happier planning, I will say, of what life is going to be like post-pandemic. And, of course, at IU, we're very fortunate to have just an incredible health infrastructure and leadership group to advise us so that we do it safely. And I'm so impressed with how Indiana University has navigated this pandemic and how it's taken care of the IU family. And then in regard to your second example, issues and challenges related to diversity and inclusion are really important, and they're front and center. And, it's something that has been, frankly, a priority for me for many years. And so I look forward to building on the good work that IU has started in that area as well.
Well, President-elect Whitten, thank you for spending a brief time with us to talk about yourself, about your position as you're coming into it as the the next president of Indiana University. And we certainly hope you have a chance to visit you not only here on campus in Gary, but through the system as well. And thank you for spending time with us today on the phone.
My pleasure. Go IU.
And President-elect Whitten is going to be taking over for the retiring Michael McGrabe during the summer months. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. More than 81,000 fatal drug overdoses happened in the United States in a 12-month period that ended in May of 2020, which is the highest number of overdose deaths ever recorded in that period of time. That's according to the CDC. And while overdose deaths are already increasing, and because of just before the pandemic, we've noticed it had an acceleration of substance abuse issues as we're fighting the COVID-19 pandemic. Let's find out more about the impact that COVID-19 is having on substance abuse disorders. We have Christy Carney. She is the Director of Behavioral Health for Indiana with CareSource. And Christy, thank you very much for being with us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. I appreciate the invitation. COVID has impacted those with substance use disorder very hard. We are seeing health concerns. We're seeing, a lot of our membership has financial worries. They've lost jobs. They've lost their insurance. COVID has created a lot of isolation and uncertainty and anxiety and loneliness. And I think all of those have contributed during the pandemic and have impacted mental well-being. So I do think that COVID has impacted those with SUD and has made it very difficult.
I was looking at information that has come in as well from some of the counties around the state. And in Marion County alone, which is, of course, the biggest populated county in the state and in a way very close to Lake County and Porter County here in northwest Indiana, that there have been so many, many EMS calls that have involved accidental overdoses. Will you tell us about the information there? And now, because of the pandemic, it's just accelerated even more. What do you find in looking at the data from your end at CareSource?
Well, according to some of the information I read in Marion County, they saw an increase of accidental overdoses by 43% of those EMS calls, and calls for naloxone or Narcan increased 61% after the public health emergency order was issued since March of 2020. There's been a lot of isolation that's happened during COVID, a lot of job loss and unemployment and financial worry. People have a lot of anxiety and uncertainty that has contributed to the increase in substance use disorder and maybe the increase of those EMS calls.
Now, I know the CareSource has a number of of care items under their umbrella, but I understand that the organization's had a very long history of working with populations to be able to address the need for some kind of substance abuse disorder treatment. Can you tell us about that?
CareSource has been around for over 30 years, and we're a managed care entity. We are in Ohio, Georgia, West Virginia, Kentucky, Indiana. I'm specifically focused in the Indiana area, mm-hmm. and one of the things that we're focused on is we're getting more of our Medicaid members into more care, and actually between 2019 and 2020, we've seen an increase of 68% of our Medicaid membership in Indiana receiving a substance use-related service. So we're really pleased to see more members getting more care. That's our goal at CareSource. We really want to thank our partnership with the state and their commitment to this population. They put a lot of things in place during COVID so that members wouldn't lose their benefits. And we're just really grateful to the state and our community mental health centers and the communities that we serve. We think that the state has done a great job of helping us work and increase provider capacity so that we can serve more members with substance use disorder treatment. We're really encouraged by getting more people and more treatment.
Now, Christy, I understand that luckily, it may hopefully not have to be used, but sometimes it does. Narcan has, of course, kept many people alive, brought them back to life, I guess, in some instances, and that Narcan is covered for Medicaid members, which I understand is a very important part of the CareSource services.
Yes, Narcan is covered by Medicaid, and so we try to make that easily accessible for our members so that they have that available to them.
I also understand, too, that self-care is a very important part of trying to deal with any kind of substance abuse disorder treatment. Can you tell us some of the ways that CareSource is able to work with some of the clients and others that need the help to be able to deal with the problems they may have taken on because of drug addiction?
At CareSource, we provide all levels of treatment for our members across the substance use disorder continuum. So we offer inpatient treatment for our members. We offer residential treatment. We offer psychotherapy services, intensive outpatient treatment, partial hospitalization. So all levels of treatment. Our goal is to get the member in the right level at the right time. And so we provide a holistic treatment.
Mm-hmm.
We have care management at CareSource. So we have nurses, social workers, and community health workers that are available to work with our members and help them wherever they are in their recovery process and connecting them to care so they can continue their recovery.
I understand holistic treatment is really very important. You wouldn't think so, but it really is. It probably is almost as important as having to take medication.
Holistic care is very important, looking at the whole person and really just looking at substance use disorder as a chronic illness. We would want to treat that person the same as we would treat anybody with diabetes who needs insulin. And we really need to take that into consideration that it's a chronic illness. It's treatable. We need to encourage people to get treatment. We know treatment works, and we need to treat that whole person, that holistic.
Now, if anybody is interested in finding out more of the health services that CareSource can provide, especially in this particular area of substance abuse treatment and disorders, how can they get hold of you folks?
They can call our member services, and they can call 1-833-674-6437 to reach a care advocate. So they can call that number, member services, and they can request care management. Any member can be referred and have a case manager. We also have an addiction line for those that are struggling. Members can be reached, can use that number at 1-855-475-3163.
Christy Carney is the Director of Behavioral Health in Indiana for CareSource. And Christy, thank you for the great information and the best of luck in helping more Hoosiers, and particularly those on Medicaid, to get the help they need to fight the drug abuse problems they have and stay alive in many cases. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you. I appreciate your time.
Christy Carney says that there are nearly 10,000 Indiana members with CareSource who are now suffering from substance use disorders. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. The 2021 Indiana General Assembly session has ended. Well, at least the official part of it, the unofficial part, that is the part where lawmakers will have to come back later and deal with redistricting, is finished. And that means that the measures that have gone into the hopper and have come out of the hopper and in some cases have died or are still alive and have gone on to the governor's office for review. Some of them involve the environment, and that means we're asking now to find out the latest from Jesse Carbonda. He's the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. And Jesse, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Well, you're not a happy camper in some respects, maybe in some, but not all respects. If you will, give us from the Hoosier Environmental Council the assessment of how the 2021 session went as far as the environment is concerned.
Well, I think that the general perception is that it was a very, very tough tough session for the environment. And I think that there is definitely truth to that. But one thing that I want to do at the onset is say that we can claim that there have been three victories with respect to environmental health in terms of two bills that were outright defeated and one that was significantly amended. So that's a win for the environmental community. Secondly, there was a bill that would have significantly set back mass transit efforts in central Indiana, and I think would have sent a very negative signal to transit agencies across Indiana had it gone through, and that too, that was defeated. On the positive end, that there's going to be historic investment in open space protection in the HB 1001, the biannual budget, and we can certainly claim credit in part for that win. And finally, pollinator-friendly solar is going to be preserved in our state. And what I mean by that is that counties will have the opportunity to continue to enact ordinances that foster pollinator-friendly solar. So those were the wins, but there were certainly some major headwinds as well.
If you will, fill us in on some of, we'll go through the victories first. What are some, in particular, some of the victories that the HEC can certainly see that Hoosiers will benefit from?
Absolutely. I think above all would be SB 411, which had it passed, would have effectively stripped the victims of pollution from being able to obtain relief in court if the offending polluter was otherwise in compliance with environmental law. So that bill, we raised sufficient alarm, as did state agencies, that ultimately that bill was never heard. And then another bill that, again, would have really had an adverse consequence on pollution in our state was HB 1436. And in its original form, it would have really deterred our state environmental agencies, most noteworthy IDEM and DNR, from taking needed lawful action to tighten environmental protections for fear of having to pay the legal fees of polluters in the event that the agency's decisions were reversed in court. And thanks to a significant amendment to that bill, it was significantly narrowed in scope, and it won't have the kind of deterrence impact that the original bill would have had. And the final bill would have stripped local governments of the ability to protect themselves from factory farm pollution on the outskirts of their cities. And thankfully, that provision in a broader bill, which was HB 1337, was stripped out of the bill in the Senate.
Were there any other measures that came through the General Assembly this session that dealt with, we mentioned here about the factory farm pollution, concerns about that have been protected, I guess, because of a measure. I know there are other concerns in particular that we're dealing with land and water and wildlife, about the Indiana protected wetlands. And I guess that's a battle that still has to be fought, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, we have never seen a more anti-conservation bill in possibly the history of our organization, which has been around for 37 years. The original bill would have completely eliminated the bipartisan 2003 wetlands law. The bill that is heading to the governor is just almost as worse. It threatens about 500,000 acres of state wetlands because the core of the bill as it heads to the governor would completely eliminate protections for what are called Class 1 wetlands, and it would significantly reduce protections for Class 2 wetlands. And again, together, the estimated harm would be no less than 500,000 acres. And already, Chris, you know, we've seen a very precipitous decline in our wetlands in our state. We lost about 90% of our wetlands since the settlement of Indiana by Europeans.
Mm-hmm. Is there any effort that's underway here to be able to get the governor maybe to change his mind about this measure? I know that it's not over till it's over, and the governor apparently has not signed off on it yet.
Well, you know, our conversation, Chris, is very timely to your question, because literally this morning, a delegation of conservationists and environmentalists visited the governor's office this morning and delivered a letter that was signed by more than 100 conservation and environmental groups calling on the governor to veto SCA 389. And we would certainly encourage your listeners to email the governor at govholcomb@gov.in.gov to urge him to veto 389. Not only, Chris, is this the most damaging environmental bill that we've encountered in probably the history of our organization, but it's also a bill that has brought together such a spectrum of the environmental and conservation community to be opposed to it. Groups that have very different goals and different approaches, but are united in their opposition to this bill.
I know the General Assembly was also taking up some measures that involve renewable energy, and we fill us in, Jesse, on where the Hoosier Environmental Council stands on those.
Sure. Well, one class of renewable energy bills, Chris, has to do with rooftop solar. There were five bills that were filed this session related to rooftop solar, all with the intent of making rooftop solar either more accessible or more affordable. And unfortunately, all five of those bills were denied hearings, which I think speaks to the enormous political clout that the electric utility lobby has in the General Assembly. The silver lining is that three of those five bills were filed by Republicans, and it reflects the fact that rooftop solar policy is finally becoming a truly bipartisan issue. And so that presents a foundation for future success.
Are they? I'm sorry. Go ahead. Pardon me. Go ahead.
No, go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to ask, in connection with that, were there any measures that came up that the HEC supports that are in turn helping the projects that are out there, the solar energy projects that are now popping up more around Indiana?
Well, there's a bill that we really wanted to get in support of, but we couldn't quite get in support of, and that was HB 1381. This bill had to do with renewable energy siting and standards. And those standards have historically been established by local government. We do think that there is a good public policy case for certain elements of the design of solar and wind farms to be established by the state. Things like shadow flicker, signal interference, decommissioning, glares, cables. Those elements, we believe, could have been standardized across the state. And that would have expedited the investment in renewable energy. So we were generally in support of 1381, but we couldn't outright support the bill in the sense of calling on our grassroots supporters to contact our lawmakers in support of it, because we look at this bill, Chris, from two different dimensions. One is from the dimension of it helping to cut carbon emissions. From that standpoint, 1381 is a good thing. But the other lens that we look at the bill is through environmental sustainability. And it's so important that these solar and wind farms are designed right and sited in the right places so that they do not pose harm to the environment and enhance the environment. And a critical element of this bill would have stripped local government, in effect, if you carefully scrutinize the language, it would have, for all practical purposes, stripped local governments of the ability to stipulate that they want the land to be pollinator-friendly. And that's a very significant piece of this bill. Because if counties continue to be empowered with that opportunity, then it means more soil and water conservation. It means less stormwater runoff. It means more habitat for birds and bees that have suffered a tremendous decline in population over the last 50 or 60 years. And it also means that solar farms can enhance the beauty of rural Indiana rather than detract from it.
Now, finally, Jesse, are there any measures that didn't make it through the legislature this time around that may have a chance of coming up if they're sponsored and supported next session?
Oh, I would put at the top of these rooftop solar energy pieces of legislation. We also think that there is such a public health imperative to deal with big toxic threats to our waterways like coal ash and factory farming. You know, neither of those bills got hearings as well. But again, the silver lining here is that they did draw in Republican and Democratic sponsors. In fact, the coal ash bill was sponsored by two Republicans and two Democrats. So, you know, it's all about looking at the legislative session from the lens of it being a marathon, not a sprint.
Yeah. Well, Jesse, thank you for spending time with us to go over the measures that the HEC is very concerned about and made it through and didn't make it through the session. And we know that it's always next year. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Jesse Barbanda is the executive director of the Hoosier Environmental Council. Mount Baldy in Indiana Dunes National Park, which once swallowed a six-year-old boy digging in the sand back in 2013, is now taking over the exit road and the exit to the parking lot. Indiana Dunes National Park administrators are looking to the near future and the distant future as well about where the dune may go and how to provide parking once the sand dune takes over the parking lot. And that is expected to happen within 6 to 7 years from now. Lakeshore Public Radio Sharon Jackson spoke recently with Indiana Dunes National Park spokesperson Bruce Rowe about the situation, and here's the conversation.
Mount Baldy has been moving to the south. It's been averaging about 4 feet per year of movement. So the movement's nothing new. Actually, in some years, not that long ago, it was moving up to 10 or even 11 feet to the south each year. Of course, it's being moved by the wind slowly. So this year, what's happened is it has reached the exit. So the parking lot itself is not covered, but that exit road is. So a couple weeks ago, we looked out over the site and determined that we can make the Mount Baldy parking lot area a two-way. So people will go into the parking lot and then come back out the parking lot on the one road. So we no longer need to use that exit road. And we looked at a couple options, seeing if we could use heavy equipment to move the sand off of that exit road. We finally determined that it didn't make a lot of sense. It was going to continue to happen, and we'd just be interfering with what's at least a fairly natural process. Dunes do tend to move unless they get covered by marum grass or other plants that start to anchor them in place.
So what's the plan for accessing that area? Obviously, it's going to keep moving. What are you guys planning to do with that right now, then?
Well, for this year, and what should be good for several years yet, is we're going to allow the dune to continue to move, overtake that exit road, and just have a two-way in and out of the Mount Baldy parking lot. So the actual parking spots are not endangered for probably, I'd say, 6 or 7 years, just assuming an average of 4 feet movement. But in the long run, of course, at some point, that dune within, you know, like I said, 6 to 10 years, will overtake that main parking area. So we've got some time to figure it out. We're looking at some other parking areas, perhaps to the east. We've experimented with a small shuttle system a couple of summers ago, so we may look into that. Right now, we don't know what the long-term solution is, but in the short term, there'll still be access to Mount Baldy using the current parking lot.
Are you still going to be able to do tours?
Oh, yes. Yes, the dune, the beach, and the tours will still be open as they have for, you know, the last many years.
That's Indiana Dunes and National Park spokesperson Ranger Bruce Rowe speaking with Sharon Jackson. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us. Coming up on the Tuesday program, we have a conversation with Debbie Coble, who is the president and CEO of Goodwill Industries of Michiana. She will spend time online this week with a virtual conversation that's free to the public, by the way, talking about her career